Chapter 4. There was never any aftertaste to their disputes, no rankling of unspoken words or lingering of doubt. What they had in common they enjoyed. Where there were differences, they accepted them. So when, after each hunt, the pack horses brought the tusks into the camp, there was no genuine censure in Duff's face or voice. There was only the genuine pleasure of having Sean back from the bush. Sometimes it was a good day, and Sean would cut the spoor, follow, kill, and be back in the lager the same night. But more often, when the herd was moving fast, or the ground was hard, or he could not kill at the first approach, he'd be gone for a week or more. Each time he returned, they celebrated, drinking and laughing far into the night, lying late in bed the next morning, playing clabbages on the floor of the wagon between their cots, or reading aloud out of the books that Duff had brought with him from Pretoria. Then, a day or two later, Sean would be gone again, with his dogs and his gun boys trotting behind him. This was a different Sean from the one who had hoarded up at the Opera House and presided over the panelled offices in Elloff Street. His beard, no longer groomed and shaped by a barber, curled onto his chest. The doughy colour of his face and arms had been turned by the sun to the rich brown of a newly baked loaf. The seat of his pants, that had been stretched to danger point across his rump, now hung loosely. His arms were thicker, and the soft swell of fat had given way to the flatness and bulge of hard muscle. He walked straighter, moved quicker, and laughed more easily. In Duff the change was less noticeable. He was lean and gaunt-faced as ever, but now there was less of the restlessness in his eyes. His speech and movements were slower, and the golden beard he was growing had the strange effect of making him appear younger. Each morning he left the wagons, taking one of the servants with him, and spent the days wandering in the bush, tapping with his prospecting hammer at the occasional outcrops of rock, or squatting beside a stream and spinning the gravel in his pan. Each evening he came back to camp and analysed the bag of rock samples he'd collected during the day. Then he threw them away, bathed, and set out a bottle and two glasses on the table beside the fire. While he ate his supper, he listened and waited for the dogs to bark, for the sound of horses in the darkness, and Sean's voice. If the night remained silent, he put the bottle away and climbed up into his wagon. He was lonely then, not with a deep loneliness, but just enough to add relish to Sean's return. Always they moved east, until gradually the silhouette of the Zoutpansberg softened as the mountains became less steep and began to fade into the tail of the range. Scouting along their edge, Sean found a pass, and they took the wagons up and over and down into the Limpopo Valley beyond. Here the country changed character again. It became flat, the monotony of thorn scrub relieved only by the boab trees, with their great swollen trunks crowned in a little halo of branches. Water was scarce, and Sean rode ahead from each camp to find the next waterhole before they moved. However, the hunting was good, for the game was concentrated on the isolated drinking places, and before they were halfway from the mountains to the Limpopo, Sean had filled another wagon with ivory. "We'll be coming back this way, I suppose?" Duff asked. "I suppose so," agreed Sean. "Well, then, I don't see any point in carrying a ton of ivory with us. Let's bury it, and we can pick it up on our way back." Sean looked at him thoughtfully. "About once in every year you come up with a good idea. We'll do exactly that." The next camp was a good one. There was water, an acre of muddy liquid, not as heavily salted with elephant urine as some of the previous ones had been. There was shade provided by a grove of wild fig trees, and the grazing was of a quality that promised to restore the condition that the oxen had lost since crossing the mountains. They decided to make it a rest camp, bury the ivory, do some repairs and maintenance on the wagons, and let the servants and animals fatten up a little. The first task was to dig a hole large enough to contain all the 100-odd tusks they had accumulated, and it was evening on the third day before they finished.